Hey, what's up? Dexter is snoring, so it's the perfect time for me to record this little second intro. Because at the beginning of this episode you're about to listen to, you're going to hear me talk about the Patreon. And you're going to be like, what the hell? I didn't pay for this. How am I hearing it? And it's because I'm overhauling that. I'm starting over. Different plan, new schedule. 2022. Okay? So I'm going to take this episode, put it on the regular, I guess, if you will, channel. I don't know. Like, what do you call this? Podcast. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing a podcast. And I'm going to put the part two on, you know, this one as well. So you guys can, listen to that. So anyway, I just wanted to let you know that now, there's enough of me rambling and saying, within the episode, don't need to do it more here. Love you. Bye. Okay, we are here. We have made it to the first Patreon episode. Let's see what happens. I do just want to say that I feel a little bit more free in this arena to kind of be myself. And I have a really trash mouth. So I just wanted to kind of say that while I go through this story, I'll probably be more myself and say naughty words. But you can always leave me feedback if you're like, please don't do that ever again. I can't promise that I'll stop, but I will take it into consideration. So I'll try to keep it to a minimum and focus on the story. But while everything is sleeping and everything is at school and I have a few minutes and it's not windy in the garage, I'm going to get started. I might have to stop. Might have to start again. Audio might sound worse than usual, but you know why. And it's okay because you are here for a reason. And also, can you hear that? Hopefully that can pick it up. That's my computer chair. And it is a little squeaky and it's not my booty. So today we're going to talk about Samantha Koenig. A lot of people are going to associate her name immediately with Israel Keyes, which is what these episodes are going to be about. They will be about Israel Keyes. But I'm going to go ahead and do two parts. And in this first part, I really just wanted to focus on Samantha and her story because it sucks whenever you go to look up information about Samantha and it's all just riddled with Israel Keyes information. We don't care about you, Israel Keyes. But we can learn some things from him. So Samantha Tesla Koenig was born on August 30th, 1993 in Anchorage, Alaska, to her parents James Koenig Jr. and Darlene Christensen. Her parents describe her as having the biggest heart and a genuine love and care for people. Her father said that everyone who met her called her their best friend because that's just her personality. She befriended people really easily. She was funny with a sarcastic wit, excuse me, which I actually can appreciate so much. So I like that. And she loved life. Her mother says that she was beautiful, full of life and laughter, which she missed so much, her laugh. And Samantha was the fourth of six children. She had three sisters and two brothers. A high school senior attending Anchorage's West High and Avail High School, Samantha loved animals, her friends. She liked to go fishing with her grandfather. She really liked music, listening to, playing, writing, and poetry. She liked photography. She liked to camp. And she also liked to play Call of Duty with her boyfriend, Dwayne. I believe it's Tortellani. It's been some time since I've heard the audio of his last name pronounced, and I couldn't find a video to verify. So I apologize if that is incorrect, but I believe that's what it is. And he's a second. So Dwayne Tortellani the second. And she also loved lime green. That was her favorite color. She did have a history of substance abuse, but she dedicated herself to making it through school, and she was interested in working with animals. I read in a couple spots that she was interested in equestrian work or, you know, more wild kingdom type animals, so that was cool. And she also had considered joining the Navy as a nurse. Around June of 2011, Dwayne had moved in with Samantha at her father's house, and they shared a truck together. So on February 1st, 2012, he was going to pick Samantha up from the Common Grounds Coffee Shack. This was a literal shack. It was painted bright teal, and it was parked alongside of East Tudor Road in Anchorage. And coffee shacks were and still are incredibly common in Alaska, I have learned. It was a little bit back, the article that I was reading, but it was 2017. There were, I think, more than 170 coffee shacks, just these little trailers, like popped up on the sides of main roads. You can Google it and see pictures. And we have a couple of things like that here in Ohio, but not just all over the place like them. So they just had all these little trailers serving up hot bean water to the citizens of Alaska, because I'm sure they appreciate a hot beverage. And Samantha had worked as a barista at the Common Grounds Coffee Shack for less than a month. But from all accounts, she was really responsible and she was really excited to get the job as a barista. When Dwayne arrived that night, the lights were off and Samantha was nowhere to be found. Dwayne assumed that she had closed up and left, but he got a text from her around 11:30, and she told him that she just needed a few days away and was like, "Leave me alone. I'm pissed at you." Because they had been arguing a little bit back and forth via text earlier that day, because Samantha had suspicions that Dwayne was cheating on her. So back at the home that he shares with James, all of a sudden, Dwayne just gets this urge to go outside. It's like 3 a.m. and he's just like, I gotta go outside. And there's a guy in a mask digging around in his truck. And both of them just stand there. Like, Dwayne just stands there looking at the dude. The dude just stands there looking at him, and neither of them make a move. And then finally the guy shuts the door and walks away. So Dwayne goes inside and he tells James, but nobody calls the cops. And when questioned why, Dwayne says that neither of them thought that the cops would do anything until after it had been 24 hours since Samantha was last seen. So, I mean, that makes sense, I suppose, but weird. Dwayne discovered that Samantha's driver's license, which she kept tucked in a pocket of the truck's visor, was missing. On February 2nd, a Common Grounds coworker showed up and discovered that Samantha had shirked her closing duties, which, like I said, she was really responsible, so that wasn't like her at all. Whenever he discovered that the register was emptied, he felt immediately that something was wrong. She was reported missing, Samantha, and at first, the Anchorage Police Department wasn't so sure that she was a victim to any sort of kidnapping or foul play. Maybe she staged what appeared to be a robbery and took off with the money. You know, they weren't so quick to assume that this had been an abduction. It had actually taken the APD 2 days to release publicly that she was missing. Samantha's father waited outside her coffee shack for the duration of her shift the next day, which was from 1 to 8 p.m., just waiting for her to show back up. The night before, she had actually asked her father to bring her dinner, and so now her dad's standing there wondering, like, you know, what would have happened if I would have brought her dinner? Would anything have changed? So he waited there her entire shift, but she did not show. In November of 2011, Samantha had filed a restraining order against a man that she barely knew, but she was too scared to go through with it and didn't show up to court, her father had later explained. So he said, you know, I have theories of what happened to her, but I definitely believe that she was kidnapped. So rumors start flying around like crazy. People start saying it's the Russian mafia, it's the Hell's Angels, as a payback to James. Samantha had been involved in dealing drugs. Her father, he was nicknamed Sonny, and was perhaps involved in a bit of nefarious activity. And some friends told the APD that he was most concerned with tracking donations being made to aid in the search for Samantha and for the reward for the days following her disappearance. He was super active on Facebook, and he quickly raised tens of thousands of dollars for her reward fund. At one point, authorities arrive at the home, and neither he nor Dwayne would open up the door fully to let them in. So it's like they show up, and both of them squeeze out the front door. They never open the door fully. They don't let them in, and they're here to talk about, you know, their missing daughter and missing girlfriend. So authorities were like, a little red flag. It was odd behavior, but ultimately, they were just trying to conceal a grow operation in the home. In a review of the surveillance footage from Common Grounds, Samantha is seen serving what she assumed would be the night's last customer around 8 p.m. She can very clearly be seen from two different angles inside the trailer, but unfortunately, the cameras were not really focused on the window where the customers could be seen. You can find this footage really easily. It was made public, and it's about 11 and a half minutes long or so, and you can watch. There's no audio or anything, but just to kind of get an idea of what I'm saying, like you, it seemed to be that the surveillance was more focused on the employees and what they were doing than any type of danger situation with customers, because you can't see out the window. You can only see what the employees are doing. And even the outside cameras, they're just at an odd angle, and it's hard for me to explain. So if you want to look it up, you can do that. You can just type in Samantha Koenig surveillance and it comes right up, something like that. So she can be seen making an Americano, and she seemingly having an exchange with the customer while preparing the drink. Like, she's standing there making, and she looks back and she's talking to the customer, maybe asking if they want, you know, whatever, just normal. It seems very normal. She walks back toward the window to hand the drink out. She turns to look behind her. So it's like she's looking for something that the customer has asked for up against the wall. And when she turns her head back around toward the window, she immediately takes a step back and she holds her hands up. Her palms are facing outward. And she walks away and she turns off the lights. And then she comes back to the window, and then she walks back toward the back again. And then she comes back to the window and she kneels down on the floor with her back toward the window. So she's just kneeling in the dark, and shortly after, a man who was significantly taller than Samantha, she was about 5'5", he just pops in the window, just effortlessly, hops right inside, and he's wearing a hooded sweatshirt, and you can't see anything because it's completely dark. So there was really never a chance of catching a glimpse of the man because of the angles of the camera, and he knew exactly what he was doing when he had her turn the lights off immediately. So 23 days after Samantha was last seen, Dwayne receives a text around 7:45 p.m. and it says, "Connor Park, sign under pic of Albert, ain't she purdy?" And it's coming from Samantha's phone. So they race to the park. Samantha's family, they get there before the cops do. And someone finds a bulletin board with a missing dog notice. And the dog's name was Albert. Underneath this notice is a Ziploc bag with a ransom note, and scanned onto the note is a black and white photo of Samantha and part of a man's arm holding up a February 13th copy of the Anchorage Daily News. In the note, the author explains that Samantha is being held, and if $30,000 is deposited into an account that Samantha shared with Dwayne, she would be released in 6 months. The note also says that Samantha had nearly escaped twice, once on Tudor Road and another time in the desert. And the author says, "Must be losing my touch," in this ransom note. Now, APD and FBI agents were both involved in Samantha's disappearance at this point, and the ransom note was sent to Quantico for FBI analysis. They were trying to determine, was this note made by a typewriter or a computer, you know, paper type, ink type, all that stuff. The behavioral analysis unit brought in a snuff film expert to review the ransom photo, and the expert had no idea. In the photo, Samantha's skin looked healthy. She was wearing makeup. Her armpits were shaved. You know, everything, seemingly, she was alive and healthy and well. Now, I'm going to admit something here. I have thought for quite some time that the photo of Samantha that is plastered all over the internet, you will see it even if you are not looking for it when you search anything about her name, I thought it could be legitimate. But in Maureen Callahan's book, American Predator, which I got quite many details from for this episode, the mentioning about the armpits being shaved made me go, like, wait a minute, how do they know that? Because her armpits are not shown in the photo that you see online. And it was then that I realized, like, I've been suckered, because I never once looked long enough at the photo to make the connection that Samantha's hair is not braided in this widespread photo. And that is important later, because the photo, thinking that it could be legitimate, is creepy and weird. We're getting ahead of ourselves, so we'll get there. Now, James was reluctant to deposit the money, which seemed a little sketch to investigators, but his reasoning was pretty understandable and sound. He was like, what if this is just a scam to get the reward money? Because, you know, he had been so active on social media. Everyone knew how much money was being raised, so he was a little suspicious and just wanted to make sure. But on February 29th, James notified law enforcement that he would be depositing the money, and under the instruction of the FBI, he deposited $5,000. And this was an attempt to frustrate Samantha's abductor in the hopes that he would reach out. 4 hours after the deposit was made, Samantha's ATM card was used to withdraw $600. 2 hours later, $500 was withdrawn, excuse me. Half an hour after that, another withdrawal at an ATM across town. APD did not request the CCTV footage from the surrounding stores from the coffee shack until about 3 weeks after Samantha was missing. So the coffee shack was set across Tudor Road, which was a four-lane road. You know, it wasn't just like a little street that they were, it was kind of a main, I don't know if it was busy, but it was kind of a main road because there were like IHOPs and there's a Dairy Queen. And right now, I don't know if the IHOP was there then or if it's still there, but you know, it was kind of like a little shopping plaza area. And there was also a Home Depot across the street. So they had all of these businesses that potentially had footage, but it took them 3 weeks to request that. So when they finally did review that, across that four-lane road in that Home Depot parking lot was a white Chevrolet truck with no license plates. Now on March 7th was the next withdrawal using Samantha's ATM card, and this was in Willcox, Arizona, almost 4,000 miles away. So this time they catch a glimpse of a white car on the ATM surveillance, and an image specialist within the FBI painstakingly identified this as a Ford Focus, which was legitimately the most common make and model of a rental vehicle at that time in the United States. So I am positive that that car was rented on purpose. But do you want to know how they identified the car? Because the images were really grainy. They couldn't see anything. Any images of the man driving the car, like he's always wearing a disguise. He's always wearing a hood, glasses, sunglasses, a ski mask. You never see his face. But they did get the car, but they couldn't get the entire car. So they actually determined that this was a Ford Focus because of windshield analysis. Does anybody else find this like incredible? Windshield analysis. So an officer goes to a dealership and compares the findings to a Ford Focus that they had on the lot. And they were like, yeah, this is it. It blows my mind. So anyway, there's another withdrawal in Lordsburg, New Mexico. Whoever was using the card was trying to withdraw an amount exceeding the daily limit. So they were getting notifications, and the person using the card was like popping all over the place trying to get money out within the time frame, and you know, trying to at some points use different time zones in order to get money out before he would have normally been able to get money out. I hope that makes sense. Now, information on this Ford Focus had been sent out to local authorities, and on March 13th, a trooper spots a car matching the description parked in front of room number 115 at the Quality Inn on South First Street. This is unrelated, but if you listened to the recent episode covering Casey Woody's story, Nasty David Fuller was also found by locating a car parked in front of a room at a Motel 6, and can you guess what number that room was? Yes, you were right. It was 115. I don't know. It's illogical, but I will never be staying in any room numbered 115. Just wanted to announce that publicly. So the trooper sits and he waits, and he sees a man looking down at him from the room above. And a short while later, this man comes into the parking lot, and he gets into the car, and he drives off. And the trooper follows him, looking for any reason to pull him over. He has nothing. He's got no probable cause to stop this car. They get stopped at a light, and when the Ford Focus pulls off from the light and the speed limit is 55 miles per hour, he exceeds it by 2 miles per hour, and the trooper is like, this is it. I have found my reason. So he pulls him over, and the car pulls into the Cotton Patch Cafe parking lot in Lufkin, Texas. The driver of the vehicle tells the trooper that he was in town with his daughter for a family wedding, and his name is Israel Keys, and he lives in Alaska. In the passenger seat, authorities can see highlighted maps of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and in his wallet, is a debit card belonging to Dwayne and a driver's license belonging to Samantha, along with Samantha's cell phone, a gun, and disguises which match the ATM surveillance videos. So they're like, hey, bud, why do you have all of these things inside your car? And Keyes tells the FBI that he had left the window cracked in his work truck. He owned his own construction company called Keyes Construction. So he leaves the window cracked in his truck, and one day he goes out, and inside is just a Ziploc bag. And inside that is just a phone and a debit card with the pin scratch on it. Just miraculously showed up, slid in through the cracked window. And Israel Keyes just assumed that it was some sort of payment for a contracting job. Yeah. What actually happened is on the night of February 1st, he abducted Samantha from the common grounds purely out of convenience. There were several tall snowbanks near the shack, and it was open later than the other shacks nearby. That was his reasoning. It was open later than others. He had told Samantha not to hit any panic button, which the kiosk did have because he had a police scanner in his ear, which he did have, and he would have known and he would have killed her. Those long ass minutes that they spent inside the dark together, he was initially waiting for Dwayne to show up around 8:30 because he was going to abduct both of them. But minutes before Dwayne pulled up, he was like, nah, it's going to be too much, too complicated. I don't want to risk it. So he led a zip-tied Samantha with napkins shoved into her mouth out of the common grounds shack and toward Tudor Road. Now, while they were making their way across the street to go to Key's truck, he looks down on the ground. They're going to cross the street, and there's a new Canon camera laying on the ground. And he's like, oh, man, this is worth like $300. So he stops to pick it up. And Samantha seizes the opportunity, and she breaks free, and she starts running. But Keyes tackled her in the middle of the street. And there are people that are around. There are people in the parking lot. There are people getting into their cars. Like, this is not a desolate, you know, 2 a.m., like, bold. He's bold. So he tackles her, stands her upright, walks her to his truck, and was holding a .22 caliber gun against her, and it was out of sight. And he tells her, like, stumble around, look like you're drunk, and lean on me so that it would not be suspicious that just the way her arms looked, the way she was walking, that they were so close together. And when they arrived at his truck, they waited outside before he helped her in because there were people in the very car right next to them to their left. So they wait for them to like do what they're doing and leave and stuff before they get in his truck because she's all zip tied. He has to help her in the truck. And the whole time she stands there waiting, not screaming, not saying anything because again, he had a gun, but he had also whispered into her ear that he would kill her if she did anything. And he had also been telling her the whole time that as long as you cooperate, as long as you do what I say, you don't yell, you don't scream, you don't hit the panic button, you don't do anything, like, I'm not going to hurt you. If you cooperate, I'm not going to do anything bad to you. I'm just holding you for ransom. This is all about the money. Now, remember how I said that he had been texting from Samantha's phone? Yeah, he initially forgot that at Common Grounds. So he went back. I didn't write down the exact timeline of him going back and what he went back for, so I apologize for that. But it's between 2 to 3 times that he returned to this place with all these people where he had just abducted a girl. And just, I don't know. It seems crazy. But the thing about Israel Keyes is he's pretty steady. Like, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but he's calm, cool, collected, doesn't seem to be chaotic. Why are you going back so many times? Like, you're exposing yourself so many times. And in that book that I referenced, and I'll put it in the show description, he talks about like 6 witnesses. 12 witnesses, 6 to 12, something like that. A lot of people seeing this guy, he just doesn't give a shit. He does not. None. Okay, moving on from my little tangent. During their time together in his truck, Samantha is trying to talk him out of all this, and he's telling her to shut up, but he explains that he, quote, wasn't really mean about it. Like, okay, like, you're such a good guy. Like, what a hero. I hate when you listen to interviews from monstrous people, and they're like, well, you know, I wasn't mean. I wasn't a dick about it. I let him do this. I let him go pee. Like, okay. So speaking of, listen to the nice thing that he does next. At some point, she winds up in the back seat covered up with a tarp because she had said that she was cold. And then she's like, I have to go to the bathroom. So they pull over. He puts a rope around her neck to act as a leash, and he gets her out at Earthquake Park. Now, this is a 134-acre park, and it's set back in the forest because in 1964, the whole neighborhood that had once existed just fell into the ocean because they had a 9.2 Richter scale earthquake, which lasted about 4 minutes. So now it's this giant park. And the pictures of it are really gorgeous, but it's a little haunting and creepy looking at them, knowing what you know now. And the rope was just long enough for her to be able to get low enough to relieve herself. So he's literally walking her around like an animal on a leash. And she has to just squat and relieve herself in front of him. I hate him. So then he lights up one of those stupid-ass cigars he's always smoking. And he would hold it to her mouth like he's sharing it with her because he's such a nice guy after she's got to go to the bathroom. I don't know why that bugs me, but it does, and I wanted to tell you guys about it, and I hope it bugs you too. Then he takes Samantha to the home that he shares with his girlfriend and his 10-year-old daughter. He tells her to lay down and be quiet, and she obeys. She's laying in the back of his truck under a tarp while he goes inside to check on his family. He comes back out, and he takes her to a shed. Like, literally, they're in their driveway. He's walking her back to a shed in front of the whole neighborhood and God. I mean, it's dark, but it seems pretty bold. I don't know how late it is at this point. Maybe it's, I would assume it's very in the middle of the night, but still. Gets her up, walks her in, cranks up the heaters inside this shed, and then he turns on the radio, blasting metal in case she did try to scream. Again, one would think that the neighbors might be like, hey, buddy, shut the fuck up. Like, it's the middle of the night and you are blaring heavy metal. I guess that's Alaska. I don't know, man. It didn't grab anyone's attention. Like, nobody did anything. So he restrained Samantha inside the shed with rope secured by two anchors into the wall. He uses a bucket for her to pee in, and then he empties it, and it's dual purpose because it becomes her chair where he props her up. And he does position her hands so that she could smoke some cigarettes that he gave her because, again, he's such a nice guy. And then he goes off inside to have himself a nice little drink of wine and check to make sure that his girlfriend and his kid aren't going to interrupt him. He initially told investigators that his girlfriend was asleep at the time, but then he later contradicts himself, and we're going to get into way more of that later. There's a lot more stuff here about Samantha and what happened, but he divulges all of this in his interviews, and he slips up a couple of times. So, like I said, we'll get into that later. He comes back out to the shed, which is now like 90 degrees. It reeks of sweat and urine and smoke, and he's got a glass of water for Samantha, and he cuts her loose from her restraints just to fuck with her. This was literally just for him to look at her face, seeing like that one last little glimmer of hope because he's cut her free and he's giving her water, and, you know, she's been smoking cigarettes, and he's been telling her the whole time, just do what I say and, you know, you'll get to go. Like, I'm not going to hurt you. It's all about money. Not true. His sole intention from the minute that he chose Common Grounds, not Samantha specifically, he didn't know her at all. Like, she was just a girl trying to make people's coffee for a few bucks an hour. He chose this strictly out of convenience because he wanted to kill. And then he wanted to maybe get some money as a bonus. But that's one of those things that we're going to get into more later. He restrained her again after cutting her loose. This time he did it more aggressively and tightly. And he still got the heavy metal music blaring. And he rapes her, telling investigators that it took between 2 to 3 songs. When he was finished, he stands over her and she asks him, "Are you going to kill me?" And he simply says, "Yes." Of course, this is all his account, okay? And he really likes to hear himself talk, and he's kind of full of shit. Like I said, he's really calm and cool and collected, but he does like to talk, and he does say just shit sometimes. He kind of talks in circles. I would definitely recommend, if you are fascinated by this sort of thing, to watch the FBI interview tapes. They are three separate interviews kind of spliced into one. It's 6 hours of footage, but they've got more than 40 hours of interview footage. And a lot of it is not public because it's like real gross. I mean, obviously I don't know because I haven't heard it, but just what is public and what they didn't release tells you how bad it is. But in the book, you get all of the stuff that they did not release publicly in the tapes. So anyway, the point of that was, who knows? Who knows anything of what he's saying, because it's all coming from him. Because unfortunately, after this happens, he strangled her. And according to him, she did not make a single sound as he did so. He had stabbed her in the back near her shoulder. So he wrapped her up in a tarp, turned off the heaters, double locked the shed, went inside to shower, woke up his daughter, made her breakfast, and then they took off in a 5 a.m. cab for the airport, because guess what? He was going on a 2-week cruise with his family. So he gets back to Anchorage on February 18th, and then he starts dismantling the shed on February 21st after his daughter left for school, and he's using contractor bags to put everything in. Overnight, he burnt the tarp that Samantha had been in, and he scrubbed the floor with bleach. But in order to keep the floor clear while he was cleaning up, he strung her up with the rope inside the shed, and then he put down plastic everywhere. He told investigators that he thawed out her body, which became, quote unquote, very floppy, and proceeded to have sex with her corpse. His daughter came and knocked on the shed door, like, my God, like, he is inside being, I'm covering my mouth, just, he's doing these horrific, monstrous things, and his 10-year-old child is outside of the door knocking, like, hey, I gotta get ready for school, like, can you come in and help me? So he does. He goes inside and he gets her ready for school. And then after school, he takes his daughter to Target and he purchases a Polaroid camera. Unfortunately for him, this location did not carry the film that went into that Polaroid. So after homework and dinner and making sure that his daughter was asleep, he leaves her alone in the home and he drives like an hour to another location, another Target that had the film. I wanted to kind of say his girlfriend, she, you know, was there, but she worked in healthcare and I would assume worked overnight sometimes, because there's several times that you're like hearing that his daughter is alone and you're like, where's the girlfriend? So she was probably at work. And he says that he does a lot of this work overnight before before his girlfriend would arrive home in the morning from work. So anyway, while he's out getting this film, he grabs a copy of the Anchorage Daily News dated February 13th from a dumpster. He was gathering all the items that he needed to produce a ransom photo 21 days after he had already murdered Samantha. He drives back home and he gets to work. He's putting makeup on her and he tells investigators that it took somewhere between 3 to 5 hours to put her makeup on. He got this makeup from Samantha's own purse. He got some that his girlfriend left lying around and he made a special purchase at Walmart for makeup. He says that Samantha was wearing several different kinds of foundation, and after trying to use super glue on her forehead and her eyes to make her have some sort of expression, because the muscles in her face had at that point gone slack. He just taped her mouth shut. And that was another detail to debunk the photo that's online. The woman in that photo does not have tape over her mouth. He used 10-pound test fishing line to sew her eyelids open. He began at the brows in between her eyes, and he went down, and then he would go back up along her nose cartilage, repeating the process on both sides until her eyes stayed open because he sewed them open. So that's fucking terrifying. And in this photo that you're thinking this in your mind, in this photo that you see online, but now knowing that this is not the photo, I'm so glad that I've never seen the legitimate photo. I don't want to ever see it. Because you can't really tell in that photo that her eyes would have been sewn, and it's because they're not. So I can't imagine what it would look like in the original. The picture that's on circulating online, I believe it was created for a Dark Minds episode. So it is a live person. Anyway, it's fucking creepy. It's really, really, really disturbing. And I know this story. I've known it for a long time. I've typed this out. I've watched stuff. I've read stuff. I've listened to stuff. But I'm sitting in my house alone and I'm getting like the heebs, man. I hate it. So it's all so unreal and it's all brutal. But for whatever reason, thinking about him braiding her hair is the worst part to me. So yeah, he braided her hair for this picture, put her makeup on, braided her hair. I'm pretty positive that he changed her clothes, but that hasn't necessarily been verified because he says something in the transcript and the reporter, it's unclear if she had typed chained, like chained her up because he was chaining her, you know, with those anchors and stuff, or changed her clothing. As we know what Samantha was wearing when she was last seen, but we've never seen the original picture, so I'm not sure. But I would assume that he had changed her clothing for the photo to make her look as presentable as possible. So after he braids her hair, and one last thing I'm going to say about the braiding, the photo that is out there, the hair on that woman is just hitting like near her collarbone. It's loose. It is unbraided. So again, I never looked at it long enough to make that connection. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm glad that that's not the original photo because I was horrified that someone's family member had this picture just so easily accessible if it was to be the true picture. It's really kind of messed up. So I'm glad that it's not. So after he does all that, he braids her hair, puts her makeup on. I'm sorry I went off this tangent. I'm getting to the point, I promise. Here we are. He holds up her head and he positions the paper and he takes a selfie. Like, legitimately, I didn't think about how his stupid ass would have been holding the camera before and like snapping the picture until I started writing this episode, and it makes me hate him more because just picture it. Then he cuts off the edges of the Polaroid because his arm had moles and he was afraid that they could be identified. And so he scans the picture and then he prints it out in black and white because he believes that it would be harder to trace than the original Polaroid. So like all of this, he's so paranoid. He does all this stuff. He actually mixed her change from her purse in with his own change. When they asked him why, he was like, I don't know, because I was paranoid. Like, he's taking so many precautions. He was so meticulous, but you didn't know an ATM card could be tracked. Like, he literally told investigators, like, no, like, nah, I didn't know. And I don't want to give him credit for anything, but Israel Keyes is not stupid. He was not one of those, he's so smart, he's stupid guys. Like, he was very intelligent. So I find it very hard to believe that he would go to all the links that he went to and not know that he could be tracked by an ATM card. I'm not necessarily buying it. And when I say that, I mean, I feel like he wanted to get caught. That's my personal opinion. And we're going to get into a lot more of this when we talk about Israel Keyes and his background and his other victims and just all of the terrifying stuff that you probably never wish to know. But I am going to put out there for you anyway. A lot of people have a lot of theories about why he would be so sloppy or careless. So we'll get into all that. But he used a typewriter, in fact, that he had found at Goodwill to type up the ransom note. And that has also never been released to the public, which I am glad, because again, you have to think about Samantha's family. Like, if this was my family, not a chance in hell I'd want to see that shit plastered around. Like, I don't. Would I want someone to tell the story about my family? Most likely, yeah. Would I want people to be looking at the worst mementos? No. So I'm glad that they aren't out there. But so we don't know everything that it contains, just little snippets from interviews and stuff. He admits that he was not ready to get rid of her yet. He says, quote, wanted to keep her. But he did what most other, like, asshats can't do that do these kinds of things. He knew that he had to do it, and he had to do it then instead of trying to keep little trophies and keep this and that, because her body was beginning to smell. Okay, because remember, she had been deceased for 2 weeks in a shed, and he's out on a Caribbean cruise. Now it is Alaska. It was like 20 degrees. He was not concerned because he knew that she would be frozen, essentially. I mean, he had to thaw her body out. So he wasn't really too worried. He also had been keeping an eye on the Anchorage police blotter. Like I said, he had a scanner in his ear. Like, the guy was not dumb. And he had been tracking and reading, and he knew that APD had nothing. So no, he was not concerned. But once he gets home and he's like thawed her out, you know, nature is having its way. So he's like, I gotta do this now. So he immediately cuts up the table that had been holding Samantha, and he burns the pieces. He put Samantha's body in a rolling tote, and it was just a few inches deep, to dismember her body. And it took him 3 separate trips to Matanuska Lake, where he disposed of Samantha's body through the ice in which he had cut a hole. He told investigators that he thought maybe it was like 2 feet or so thick. When they went out there, it was actually like three feet thick, or 3 inches. I'm saying feet, aren't I? 3 inches thick. That's some thick ice. And he was doing this all without using this ice drill, because a man fishing nearby was watching him curiously, like, why is this dude going and doing all this without asking me to borrow my ice drill that is clearly sitting right here available? But he got it done. He disposed of her remains, and then he caught some fish. He went to a parent-teacher conference to discuss the gifted program that his daughter was entering, and he went home to eat the fish that he had caught in the water where he was disposing of Samantha's remains. On April 12th, 2012, a team of forensic divers located one of Samantha Koenig's feet. Close by, they located her torso, and the divers explained that while people think that you're weightless in water, the very opposite is true, and it was a really difficult task to get Samantha into the body bags because of the weight and the slippage. All of Samantha's remains were recovered in the area that Keys had said they would be. Samantha Koenig was cremated at sunrise on Easter Sunday in 2012, and a celebration of life was held on April 22nd, 2012 at the West High School Auditorium. Her family also held a remembrance room for 4 days before the service. And in the closing of her obituary, it stated, "In lieu of flowers, the family asks that you keep Samantha in your thoughts by sharing a smile and a laugh with those you encounter." And I thought that was really kind of a testimony to the person that she was. And I just liked it, so I wanted to share it with you guys. And like I said, you know, this is just part one of Israel Keys, because I wanted to start and I wanted to focus on Samantha's story. And it just makes me sad, because obviously her name is going to be attached to him for the rest of time, but she deserves for the world to know, you know, at least a couple of things about just Samantha. And while a lot of the details here are, you know, graphic and unthinkable, they kind of give you an idea of what we're going to learn about this guy in part two. And I'm sure that it provides zero solace to her family, but her death was ultimately involved in bringing an absolute downright monster to an end. So, next episode, we will go into more depth about his FBI interviews. I've still got a couple of hours to finish on those before I can get that episode completed. So it's going to be kind of a hybrid of the interviews that I've released publicly to by audio, and then all the information that I got from reading the American Predator book. So stay tuned for the next installment of this god-awful story.